It is gone! A two-run home run for Rhys Hoskins into the second deck for Bryce Harper. Drag and a miss. He got him. And Aaron Nola leads two. Segura on the run. Reaches up and makes the grab.
Swing and a miss. Struck him out.
Now batting for the Phillies, John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode number 426. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter at John Stolness. Coming up, I'm going to talk to Dan Zimborski from Fangraphs and ESPN. We're going to get his thoughts on the World Series going on right now between the Dodgers and the Rays, and I'll also pick his brain about what he thinks the Phillies will do this offseason with JT Realmuto and filling some of their other needs, and what he thinks might happen with the front office. We'll get to all that coming up here in just a few minutes. It was 40 years ago this week that the 1980 Phillies broke a 96-year curse and won the franchise's first World Series title. And I've got a piece up on The Good Fight detailing that whole 1980 season that I think you guys will really like. And I'll just give you a brief taste of it coming up here during the course of the podcast. Also, Rob Manfred says some of the pandemic rules that we had this year could be staying in place in future seasons. But we'll start off the podcast talking about the Phillies' number two starter this week, who actually was the number one starter for most of the season. Free agent signee Zach Wheeler had surgery this week. It was minor surgery, so nothing to be overly concerned about. He underwent a fingernail resection on his right middle finger, his pitching hand, you know, the one he got caught in the zipper of his jeans earlier this year that forced one of his starts to be pushed back. And listen, we joked about it. We thought it was a ridiculous injury at the time, but Zach Wheeler has had this problem with one of his fingernails on his pitching hand that gets caught on things. It just grows weird, and he gets it caught on things, and he tears his fingernail sometimes. And here's the issue with that. You can't have discomfort in your fingers if you're going to be an effective pitcher. If that's causing you a lot of pain, you can't grip the baseball. So as ridiculous as it sounds, a fingernail injury to a pitcher is a very big deal. And so, it's one of those injuries you would never hear a football player missing time with, or a basketball player, maybe a basketball player, but probably not a basketball player. The other thing, too, is you can't bandage your fingers up. If you're a pitcher, you remember Trevor Bauer cutting his finger on a drone before the one of the games in the 2016 World Series between the Cubs and the Indians. He had to pitch with his finger exposed, and remember him bleeding all over the place as he's trying to pitch that game. He couldn't wear a Band-Aid. He couldn't wear it bandaged. You can't do that if you're a big league pitcher. So it was a big deal this year when Zach Wheeler messed up his fingernail. It forced him to push his start back. Thankfully, it didn't really cost him this year. He was still effective even after the fingernail injury, but it sounds like this is something that they just wanted to get taken care of. He is expected to be ready for spring training, and the Phillies desperately need him to do what he did in 2020 over a full season in 2021, because Zach Wheeler was one of the best free agent signings by any team this winter, and certainly, I think, the best free agent signing the Phillies made during the Matt Klentak era, not named Bryce Harper. The Bryce Harper free agent deal is still a good deal, no matter how you slice it. They got a team leader out of Bryce Harper. They got an up-and-down hitter, but a guy who makes a huge impact. I think we are all happy about the Bryce Harper signing. But the Phillies could have gone a number of different directions with getting a starting pitcher in the fold. And I know going into last offseason, I had said that if Zach Wheeler is your main get in free agency this year, that I didn't think it would be enough. I was wrong about that. Zach Wheeler was better than I thought he was going to be. He was consistent. He went 4-2 with a 2.92 ERA in 11 starts. His strikeout rate was down this year, 6.7 strikeouts per nine innings, but he also had his lowest walk rate of his career, 2.0 per nine, and his lowest home run rate of 0.4 per nine innings. And that is because Zach Wheeler kept the ball on the ground. His ground ball rate jumped from 43% in 2019 to a whopping 56% last year. And the guy was a double play machine. He induced 13 double play ground balls last season, second only to Kyle Freeland of the Rockies, who had 14 double play grounders. But Freeland started two more games than Zach Wheeler did. So A great season from Zach Wheeler as the team's number two starter. It was a fantastic addition this offseason by Matt Klentak. Klentak did not have a lot of clear wins in free agency or in trades, but Zach Wheeler was definitely one of them. So the good news is that hopefully this fingernail issue won't pop up again, or I guess in the case of the fingernail pop off again, I'm sorry. Hopefully this is taken care of, and it certainly sounds like he will be ready for spring training. One of the other interesting notes this week, Rob Manfred was talking to, I believe it was a group of reporters, talking to a pool of reporters before the start of the World Series, and was talking about some of the rules that were put in place for this pandemic-shortened season and the possibility of some of these rules being extended past this year. This was always the worry, that once you establish something in Major League Baseball, it's really harder to unwind it. Once it's really hard to put the toothpaste back in the tube, as they say. And so the rules put in place for the pandemic, the hope was with some of these rules, at least as far as I was concerned, they would only be temporary. But it sounds like Manfred, at least with some of these rules, want them to become permanent. And the biggest one that he says he thinks he would like to see become a new permanent rule is the extra inning rule, where you start every extra inning frame with a runner on second base and nobody out. And I gotta say, I didn't hate it as much as I thought I would. And I think that's what Manfred was picking up on. He said people were wildly unenthusiastic about the changes, and I was certainly one of them. And then when they saw them in action, they were pretty much positive. Manfred went on to say, it keeps us from putting players in situations where they're out there too long or in positions they're not used to playing. I understand that. I do get that argument for it. When you have really long extra inning games, when you're going 14, 15, 16, 17 innings, sometimes you're asking a relief pitcher on short rest to do more than he should. Sometimes you're asking a relief pitcher to pitch more innings and throw more pitches than he should because you run out of guys. I do get all that. And sometimes you have to ask a position player to pitch. We all remember the Wilson Valdez game. It is an iconic game during that 2007 to 2011 stretch run that the Phillies had. And that's why I don't want this new extra inning rule to stick around. I do agree that it does increase the action. It certainly increases the likelihood that runs will score in extra innings and make games a little bit shorter. And we all want baseball games to be just a little bit shorter. They do tend to go on, but there's something fun and unique about a seven-hour extra inning game that goes 18, 19, 20 innings. They're rare. They're really weird. And they're kind of fun in a strange way. They're an endurance test. And part of baseball is endurance. I mean, we play a 162-game schedule. And I know that's a lot of innings. And you don't want one of those games to be the equivalent of two games if you can avoid it. Certainly, I do understand that. But as a fan, those kinds of unicorn games are fun. We remember the Wilson Valdez game because it was so unique, because of the weirdness that happened after. And we don't remember how the Phillies had to deal with the ramifications of it afterwards. We don't remember what happened in the intervening 2, 3, 4, 5 days after that 18-inning game, because we don't really care. We remember that night. We remember that moment. And I would hate for those kinds of moments to go away. So I didn't hate the extra inning rule as much as I thought I would, because it was kind of fun to know that once the 10th inning rolls around, already you're starting off extra innings with a runner in scoring position. And so what do you do? Do you butt them over and look for the sacrifice fly to play for one run? If you're the visiting team, you probably don't do that. If you're the home team, you certainly do that. So I think it certainly gives home teams a big advantage in extra innings. At least it should give home teams a big advantage in extra innings, because you already know what the visiting team has done in the top of the inning. You know whether or not you need to play for one run or two runs or three runs. So your strategy drastically changes if you're the home team. If you're the away team, I think you have to play for multiple runs. I don't think you can, unless you know you've got lockdown relievers and you feel really good about shutting down the home team's offense, I think you got to play for multiple runs. I don't agree with bunting the runner over to third base and trying to get him in with a sacrifice fly if you're on the road, because you know the home team's going to have the exact same scenario in their bottom half of the inning. And it's just a matter of, do you believe the other team can execute? So that rule certainly does give home teams a big advantage, and maybe that's something the players want. Because all of these rules that have happened, there must be an agreement between the Players Association and the league to make these rules permanent. And it's a matter of, do the players want to make these games shorter? They might. They might decide, you know, I can't imagine there's a lot of players that like playing in 16, 17, 18 inning games. My guess is they hate it. And so maybe there are more baseball players who, they might be traditionalists, but also understand that this is maybe more advantageous for my health. This is, no one wants to be at the ballpark on the field for 6 hours or 7 hours. As a fan, it's certainly more fun, but I could understand if the players union decides, yeah, let's keep the extra inning rule going forward. I would hate to see it. I don't want to see it become permanent. I am more of a traditionalist in this way. I would hate to lose those marathons because they're rare. They don't ever really happen. I mean, there's a reason we remember them, and it's because they are so rare. So I'd hate to see that go away. There would also need to be agreement for the postseason expansion to become permanent. Right now, it went from 10 to 16 teams here in 2020 because of the pandemic, as Major League Baseball tried to make up for some of the revenue lost by not having fans in the stands during the 60-game regular season. Also, making the designated hitter in the National League permanent would need to be agreed to. I think the DH to the National League, maybe it's not in place for 2021, although my guess is I think there will be an agreement in place to at least get that set up for next year, because I don't think we're ever going to see pitchers hitting again. And did anybody miss the strategy this year? Can you honestly look back on the 2020 season and think of all those Phillies games you watched this year and how you missed so much all the National League strategy? Did you even notice? I don't even think you noticed. If you noticed, tell me how you noticed. I would love to know. Hashtag DHNL. And let me know if you really did truly miss pitchers hitting, because I don't think anybody noticed. Nobody was talking about it during the regular season. Nobody gave it a second thought. And frankly, it allowed us to see Alec Bohm earlier than we would have. It allowed us to see more good Phillies hitters in the lineup than we ordinarily would have. So obviously, you know where I come down on the designated hitter in the National League. I think it absolutely should be a permanent part of the game. Expanded playoffs. I also hate the 16 teams in the playoffs. And that is one thing that Manfred said he didn't think would stick around. He said, I don't think we would do 16 like we did last year. I think we do have to be cognizant of making sure that we preserve the importance of the regular season, but I think something beyond the 10 that we are at would be a good change. So maybe you add one additional playoff team per league. I would be all right with that. If that enables you to maybe give the team with the best record in each league a bye, okay, I'd be down with that. I would be down with expanding it from 10 to 12. An extra three teams in each league is too much. We just saw, it's ludicrous that the Phillies still had a chance at the postseason on the last day of the season this year. There's just no way that should have been possible. There's no way the Phillies should have been anywhere close to playoff position. And oh, it would weaken the regular season. There was a time, and almost none of you listening, and I certainly don't remember, when you played a 154 or then 162 game regular season, and one team from each league not only just went to the playoffs, they went right to the World Series. That's when winning the pennant was actually winning the pennant. You had to beat out 8 or 9 other teams in order to win the pennant and go play in the World Series. You didn't have long playoff series. Now, of course, the birth of the divisional format changed everything, but even then, you only had two teams from each league making the playoffs. You had an ALCS and an NLCS. And then you had a World Series, and that was it. So the 162-game regular season really mattered. Now, there were fewer teams in the league at that point, so you didn't have as many teams vying for playoff spots. And I know Major League Baseball now, with this many teams, there are a lot of players, there are a lot of cities, there are a lot of franchises that you want to keep involved. We want to see pennant races and playoff races throughout the course of September. And, you know, it would happen a lot where one team just runs away with one of the four divisions, and in August and September, it's largely uncompetitive. with the wild cards, there are more teams involved. There are more teams fighting for playoff spots, and I get it. So I don't want to necessarily go back to just having four playoff teams. I think the 10 that we have is good. I have no problem with the postseason format that we have had up to this point. We're not seeing wild card teams winning the World Series all that much anymore. Once in a while it happens, but there was a run there where wild card teams were winning the World Series more than the division winners were. And we're just not seeing that quite as much anymore. That being said, I think if we moved it to 12, added an extra team in each league, that's probably fine. And it sounds like that's the direction Major League Baseball is going to go. But I am relieved to see that Rob Manfred realizes that even 16 playoff teams is too many. Sometimes too much of a good thing will make you sick. We know if you have children, you tell them that all the time. And it was cool to have eight baseball playoff games in one day. I do get that was a pretty cool thing, but I think that should be a one-year thing, and we shouldn't be moving forward with that after this year. So again, I think we will see slightly expanded playoffs starting in 2021, but not to the degree with which we saw it this year. All right, coming up next, we're going to talk to Dan Zimborski from Fangraphs and ESPN. We'll get his thoughts on the Phillies' offseason coming up and the World Series taking place right now. That's coming up next here on Hittin' Season. And we're back on Hittin' Season. So I'm going to play an interview I did with Dan Zimborski after Game 1 of the World Series earlier this week. And just so everyone's aware, we had some microphone issues on my end with my microphone. So unfortunately, the sound quality of my microphone isn't going to sound as good as it does right now. So just wanted to give you a heads up on that. But I think it works okay, and we wanted to make sure we kept the interview in this week's episode of the show. But just wanted to make you aware of some slight microphone issues that we had with Dan, with me recording Dan as we were doing this podcast. And joining me to talk a little bit about the Fall Classic, and we'll get into some Phil's thoughts here in just a few moments, are one of my favorite guests on the podcast, Dan Zimborski, senior writer for Fangraphs. He contributes for ESPN. You know him as the Zips guy too, probably, and you can follow all his work at Fangraphs and on Twitter at DZimborski. Dan, welcome back to Hittin' Season. How are you, my friend?
I'm pretty good, John. How are you doing?
We're doing fine. And the Fall Classic is here. We are recording this the afternoon after Game 1 of the World Series. And, you know, it looked like it was going to be such a fun pitcher's duel at the start, didn't it? You had Tyler Glasnow and Clayton Kershaw going at it one-on-one. And it looked like it was going to be one of those games that was 2-1 going into the ninth inning or something like that. And then the Dodgers just opened up the throttle, and that was it. It was really something else. What was your take on Game 1?
Well, I think it showcased a lot of why the Dodgers are dangerous. Once you open up those floodgates a little against the Dodgers, they'll come bursting through. Yeah. It's a team that can, you know, piece runs together in such a high clip. I mean, they scored nearly 6 runs a game playing half their games in Dodger Stadium in 2020. It's a scary offense from top to bottom. It's a matchup problem for any team. It's hard to use situational relievers against the Dodgers because they're just so deep. They're one of the few teams who can rival the Rays in depth.
Yeah.
And you saw what they do when they're on yesterday.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. I mean, if you just look at the lineups, I mean, it really is incredible how the Rays have gotten where they've gotten to. And the Rays don't seem to have the firepower. And the Rays have not hit well at all in the playoffs. They've hit some home runs here and there, but generally speaking, they've managed to make it to the World Series with basically one guy, Randy Arozarena, being red hot. Manuel Margot had probably about a 4 or 5 game stretch where he was on fire as well. But for the most part, it's the Tampa pitching that has gotten them through this. And I guess my question to you is, does Tampa have enough to really give the Dodgers a series here?
Well, I think they do, but I think that their best chances of winning are a lot of like 2-1 games. Mm-hmm. I think when you talk, you know, 13-10 games, it's usually the Dodgers that are going to be on the 13.
Yeah.
I did a little thing when I was exploring the World Series for the preview for Fangraphs, because I did that one this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I found when I simulated it that the Dodgers were twice as likely to come back from a huge deficit than the Rays were. Mm-hmm. I use the example of a 4-0 first inning. The Dodgers still project under that circumstance and that assumption to have an 8% chance of coming back compared to like 4% for the Rays. It's just that the Dodgers can string so many runs together that your best chance is if you can hold the offense to, you know, a few runs, then the Rays have the pitching advantage, probably, especially in later innings,
right,
where they're just deeper overall. But in a game like yesterday, I mean, that's you saw pretty much what the Dodgers are going to do to have their best shot at winning the World Series.
What is your position on Clayton Kershaw in the postseason? Because obviously he's had an up and down postseason, and he helped get his team off to a good start in game one. But obviously his playoff numbers, his postseason numbers are significantly different than his regular season numbers. Although they're not, it's not like Clayton Kershaw has pitched to a six ERA in the postseason, a little over a four ERA in a number. And he's well over 20 playoff starts, maybe 25 playoff starts. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but
yeah, he's going near 200 innings. He's had a lot of playoffs.
Okay. So, you know, what is your position on Clayton Kershaw and his postseason performance?
I think sometimes being an analytics guy involves you having to know what you don't know. And I think at this level, we can say, hey, there's been enough time that we can say clearly that he has pitched worse in the playoffs than in the regular season. Mm-hmm. If you took his postseason performance as a whole, like a normal season, because that's what it looks like now, even taking into consideration that he's facing better offenses on average than he would during the regular season, he has pitched quite a bit worse than you'd expect from his regular season performances. The why is trickier. He's allowed a lot more home runs. I tend to think that it's more of an approach issue somehow. I can't really prove that kind of thing. I don't really tend to buy choker narratives.
Yeah.
I think that they're always too cute, too easy, and there's always tends to be a lot of evidence against it, because my personal feeling is that there really aren't chokers in baseball, because a baseball player who chokes under pressure probably doesn't get anywhere near the majors.
Right. Good point. Yeah, you don't get that far. I mean, and Kershaw certainly didn't choke in game one. Six innings, two hits allowed, one run, eight strikeouts, one walk. I mean, my goodness.
Yeah, he's had some great postseason starts.
Yeah.
I can see that. I mean, I still wouldn't agree with that kind of storyline, but I can see it being a better thing to argue if he was consistently getting killed in the postseason. Mm-hmm. But he's had some pretty great starts against some pretty great teams. And it would be weird if he was, like, selectively choking under pressure.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's for sure. That's for sure. I think it's overblown as well. But certainly some of the issues that he's had can't be ignored. But I looked great in game one, and I think most of the country is rooting for him to finally get that ring. I mean, so I guess the question here is, as we still have, we wait for the rest of the series to unfold. Obviously, the Dodgers have gotten off to a great start in game one here. They have the quick 1-0 series lead. Do you see the Dodgers going ahead and finishing things off here, getting those last three wins? And if so, how long do you think it takes them?
Well, coming into the series, because I'm conservative by nature, I predict the Dodgers in seven. Both me and Zips would be Dodgers in six now, since we know that they won game one. And that kind of changes the whole calculus somewhat.
Yeah.
I don't want to count out the Rays. I had Zips at least had the Rays as only 47-53 underdogs coming into the World Series. Now it's more like 33-67, but when you have a win in the bank. But the Rays are a really good team. I just think the Dodgers are a little better.
Yeah. This could have been a rematch of the 2008 World Series, by the way, because the Phillies then beat the Dodgers in the 2008 National League Championship Series, the year the Rays went to the Fall Classic against the Phillies. So just missed out on this being a rematch, but we're all much happier it turned out the other way, obviously. And let's talk about the Phillies here real quick as we enter the offseason. And, you know, fans want to know about JT Realmuto. And I've gotten to some interesting conversations with people on Twitter as far as whether or not JT Realmuto is the number one free agent on the market. I think he clearly is the number one free agent on the market, but I've had people coming at me with George Springer. And looking at wins above replacement as a reason for that. Trevor Bauer as a little bit ahead of JT Realmuto as far as folks who are going to be sought after this offseason. Where do you see JT Realmuto as far as in the pecking order of the free agents this year?
I would put Realmuto as the number one. I think he plays a position that isn't particularly deep right now in baseball. Mm-hmm. Like you look around the like the AL, how many teams could use a catching upgrade?
Oh yeah.
Now I think some of the more fanciful people on Twitter talking about $200 million are probably a little silly to be nice. Mm-hmm. I don't think he gets anywhere near $200 million. No. I mean, I look at Grandal's contract, and I can see Realmuto making a little more than that. But given that, I mean, he wasn't that much better going into free agency than Grandal was. And the economic outlook for baseball is considerably worse than it was a year ago, which now seems like a decade ago after this year. So I think that he probably won't be too crazy budget-wise, but he's the guy I'd be most interested in, obviously, if you need a catcher.
Do you think the Phillies are playing this right, essentially, that they're banking on the fact he's not going to get what he wants necessarily this offseason? Because we hear about the Yankees, we hear about the Mets. Both these teams could be looking at catcher. The Mets are going to have a new owner very soon, if not have it already done. And it's basically already done, all but for the final signing on the dotted lines and all that stuff. So the Mets are going to have probably the richest owner in baseball, and the Yankees are obviously deep pocketed, and they both seem to want Real Muto. What are the chances you think the Phillies are actually playing this right and will actually be able to get him back at a number that they want?
It's tricky to guess on that simply because I don't know exactly how Real Muto feels about the situation. My personal preference is to sign the guy before he hits free agency, he's a highly desired prospect, because I'd prefer not to get into a bidding situation. But he also may have a different number if he's going to sign and, essentially skip what will probably be his only big chance at a huge free agent payday. Mm-hmm. So I'm not quite sure. I tend to think that signing him before he hits free agency is the best from the team's perspective. But I don't know exactly what it would take to do that. If he says, okay, I'll sign with you guys now for 7 years, $200 million.
Yeah, you can't do that.
I'll say, yeah, I don't think I'm going to do that. Yeah. So that's kind of the X factor here.
I guess the Phillies have to decide on the walkaway number. And my guess is they have one. They had a walkaway number for Machado. They had a walkaway number for Bryce Harper. I think it got altered a little bit once Machado signed with San Diego. But I'm curious as to if you would have a walkaway number in terms of years and in terms of maybe like average annual value, because it sounds like he wants to go past the Buster Posey average annual value, and what he wants something like a Paul Goldschmidt deal, which is, I think we're looking at $26 million a year. I think I'd be okay with doing that as long as it didn't go past 5 or 6 years. But if he's talking something larger than that, that's probably where I'm walking away. What about you?
It's funny. You said $26 million a year because my walkaway number is literally probably 5130, which is $26 million a year, unless I've screwed up the math in my head, which is possible. But that's about where I am. I do think that if they can't sign Real Muto, then the Phillies do have to be creative in how they improve the roster, because they will need to replace that lost talent. They still need to improve. The team still has holes to deal with. And I think that, you want to do it sooner rather than later, because, a team's contention window is not typically endless.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, with Bryce Harper, you're in his prime. You don't want to waste any more of Bryce Harper's prime. That's first and foremost. I mean, I know he's still just 27 years old, but those years do pass by quickly if you don't get back on the horse. And so,
yeah, I remember being one of the young guys in Sabermetrics. Now I'm 42, and it's like
the years are long, the days are short, and the years are long. You know what I mean? Or maybe backwards.
And yeah. I see people like. And I see like young journalists writing to me, and they say, I love reading you growing up. I'm like, oh God, how old am I that you read me growing up? Well, I appreciate the compliment. I don't like to remember that, I'm old enough to be your dad.
Right. The compliment's nice. The implication is something I'm not wild about. Yeah, exactly. Well, let's look outside JT Real Muto, because this team does have other needs, like you mentioned. They're going to have to find a way to replace Didi Gregorius at shortstop. They don't have a great center field situation. Adam Haseley and Roman Quinn were about replacement level this year, and they have to replace Jake Arrieta in the starting rotation. And I wrote a piece for The Good Fight this week. I don't know what they're going to get out of Spencer Howard in 2021. He only pitched 24 innings this season. They can't push him too much, especially with two straight years of shoulder problems. And then, of course, you've got the disastrous bullpen. So as you're kind of looking at this Phillies team here, outside of JT Real Muto, where should they be putting their resources at the moment? Where would you put your resources and try to fix this team, given the fact they probably won't go over the luxury tax again this year?
Well, I think that they have to be willing to go over the luxury tax. They probably won't.
Yeah.
But I think they really should have a willingness to do that.
Agreed.
It's necessary because you're competing now. I would like them to see to make a deal with Gregorius. Maybe Kim coming over from Korea. I do think you have to get another infielder. I think the general problem comes is that that the free agent market isn't really super, super deep.
Yeah.
And that's a problem because the Phillies and the Braves were kind of, you know, competing at the same time, but the Braves have developed, you know, from within an Acuna and an Albies, and the Phillies haven't yet.
Nope.
Which does put them at a disadvantage, and you have to kind of make up that in money, essentially.
Yeah.
So hopefully they take a wider approach to that.
Last thing for you, the Phillies are looking for a new general manager, and there are rumors that they might be looking for a new president of baseball operations here this offseason. You know, it's Andy McPhail's on the last year of his deal, and it's unclear exactly whether or not he'd be willing to kind of step aside if the Phillies are able to grab somebody. I was talking about this on the last episode of the podcast with Justin Clue and Liz Rocher, and we were talking about, you know, what kinds of programs, teams would you want to go after? And I'm a big proponent of trying to grab people from the Tampa Bay Rays because they do seem to be able to develop talent. And more importantly than that, I think the Phillies' problem has been they have not been able to figure out how to systematically integrate all of the analytics that they have invested millions and millions of dollars in throughout the organization, which has led to issues with player development and not being able to win any trades that they've had so far. So to me, grabbing somebody from the Tampa Bay Rays who has been able to integrate all that stuff just makes all the sense in the world and give them a president of baseball operations title. Does that make sense to you? Or do you see
that? If you're going to poach, the Rays are a good team to poach from because I mean, you kind of want someone. I think the biggest thing is to avoid a retread. I don't think the Phillies should be looking as a leader on the team as someone who doesn't have experience integrating scouting stats, the whole shebang, the whole pickle. And I mean, there's a lot of names out there, Jason McLeod, Dan Kantrovitz. There's all sorts of names that are floating around, but I don't want to see someone who was, you know, a GM 30 years ago. At the risk of getting anyone mad, I don't want to see a Joe Girardi signing for the type of signing for a GM.
Right. Yeah. You don't need somebody with I want somebody who's able to, you know, I don't think, you know, throwing out scouting is the way to do it, but you know, I don't think the Rays have thrown out scouting, right?
They scout a lot. They have a lot of guys who don't have, you know, extensive statistics. Don't have like huge statistical resumes, so it is a scouting team. But I think you know the Rays are always willing to try things, and that's the kind of thing I want to see. The kind of guy I want to see as a GM.
Yeah, the name that's getting floated right now is Eric Neander. I think is a guy. You know, the Rays general manager. Give him a promotion in the Phillies front office and try and lure him away and give him a payroll.
That's the good thing because the Phillies and other large market teams like the Dodgers, obviously, they have something to offer that the Rays really can't. Now, could the Rays ownership invest more in the team? I say absolutely yes. But I think from a maximum standpoint, I don't think they'd ever have the ability to offer, say, $200 million a year for a payroll the way some teams can. And the Phillies are in the position that they do have that luxury. So when you are in that position, you should use it.
Phil, I know I said the last thing was the last thing, but this is definitely going to be the last thing, Dan. Phillies fans are feeling down about this team right now. They're not happy. Most Phillies fans don't feel like they have a lot of hope. Most of the people listening to this podcast feel like the team doesn't have any direction and things really are not feeling good as Phillies fans. As an outsider, someone who's not emotionally invested in everything that John Middleton says and all of that, what is your outlook on the Phillies for the next year or two? Do you see this as a team that still has the capability of getting better, or are you more pessimistic about the immediate future of this team?
I guess if you had to, you know, do a buy, sell, hold thing, I'd kind of be hold, mild buy. I think the Phillies have the basic facts of the path to being a great team is is still there. Mm-hmm. I think the question is that final little push. I know that this comparison won't be popular, but I think a lot about the Pirates. And the Pirates, they did not really fail rebuilding the team. They failed finding the last little bit they needed. And in the Pirates' case, it was the willingness of team ownership to invest in the team.
Right.
They had a lot of the foundation of a really, really excellent team in there, but it fell apart, and it was kind of doomed even before you talk about things like the Chris Archer trade, which in essence was essentially forced on the front office because of the basic problems with the team investing in players. And that was the only way they could get someone like Chris Archer if it had worked out.
Right.
I think the Phillies still have all the reasons you'd think the Phillies would be a good team are still mainly there. But I think they have to have a willingness to really just go for it. Mm-hmm. And no matter the consequences.
Well, Dan, it's going to be an interesting offseason here in Philadelphia, that's for sure, because we're hearing it sounds like the ownership is actually not even just talking about going over the luxury tax, but cutting payroll. And I know that that's probably going to be something we hear from a lot of owners here this offseason. So
it always amazes me that baseball owners love, even if you're going to cut payroll, I never understand why they announce it ahead of time. It's never a selling point for people that they're closing. It doesn't ease the blow. I mean, there's a lot of fast food commercials on television.
Right.
But have you ever heard like McDonald's or Burger King said, we're cutting the price that we pay for beef by 20%. Like, oh God, I don't want that hamburger now.
That's a good point.
We're cutting our fry investment. Fries will be much worse this time.
Our potatoes are going to be 10% smaller. Yeah.
Our Idaho potatoes are becoming Oklahoma potatoes. Right. Like, what?
Yeah, we're investing in New Jersey potatoes now.
New Jersey potatoes.
That's good, Dan. And I think, you know, that's kind of where we are as Phillies fans at the moment. That's a good point about the whole announcing of the payroll reduction. I guess they're just trying to make sure that they're, you know, either it's a trial balloon or just trying to brace us for the impact.
Yes. See the Red Sox and Mookie Betts.
Yeah.
Were they any happier? Like,
no.
Guess what, Red Sox fans? Tickets are on sale. We're also going to trade Mookie Betts because we're not going to compete. Like, no, this is the worst ad ever.
Right. Well, Dan, it's interesting times we live in for sure. And we'll see how the rest of the Fall Classic plays out here over the next few days. And make sure you're reading all of Dan's stuff at Fangraphs and also at ESPN. And make sure you're following Dan on Twitter at DZimborski. Dan, thanks for coming back on Hitting Season, man. I appreciate it.
Always fun. Thanks for having me, John.
Well, to wrap up this episode of the podcast, I did want to take a quick look back at the 1980 Phillies. Of course, 40 years ago this week, the Phillies beat the Kansas City Royals in Game 6 of the World Series for their first championship in team history. It was a 96-year wait for that ball club, and we look back at that team, and we think of that baseball team as just a continuation of the division winners from 76, 77, and 78 that lost those heartbreaking league championship series, one to the Reds, the Big Red Machine, in 1976, and then two in a row to the Dodgers in brutally heartbreaking fashion, especially in 1977 when they lost that Black Friday game at Veterans Stadium, one of the darkest games in Phillies history. 1979, you'll remember the Phillies fell way back into fourth place. They battled injuries all season. They picked up Pete Rose as a free agent before that season began, and Rose had a good season, but the rest of the team really suffered. And dropping back into fourth place, when the Phillies entered that 1980 season, they were not necessarily the favorites. In fact, you had the Expos were favored over them. You had the Pirates were the defending champions, and so they were favored over them. I think there were a lot of people who had the Cardinals as favorites over the Phillies at the start of the 1980 season. That team was seen, I think most people believe that the championship window had closed on that team. If it wasn't totally closed, there was just a crack. Just a little crack open left for that team to win a championship, that group of players to win a championship. And heading into the 1980 season, the Phillies had a new manager, of course, as you all know. Dallas Green was hired at the end of the 1979 season. He took over for Danny Ozark with about a month left in 79 to audit the team, essentially, to let management, Paul Owens, the general manager, know what needed to be fixed and what didn't need to be fixed. The 79 Phillies had a decent September, so Owens and the Phil's front office decided to just keep Dallas Green where he was. And of course, Green was a combative personality. He was the anti-Danny Ozark. Ozark was loved by Mike Schmidt, Larry Boa, Gary Maddux, Bob Boone, Greg Luzinski, all those guys. Dallas Green was a bucket of cold water in the face to all those guys. He called them out on a number of different things, called them a country club team, said that they like to talk the talk, but they didn't walk the walk. And it was an abrupt change when Dallas Green came on board in 1980, and the season did not start great. They played close to 500 ball for much of the season. They hung out in first, second, third place for most of the season heading into mid-August. No one was running away with that division. So even though the Phillies weren't playing great, the Expos weren't playing great, the Pirates had taken a step back a little bit that year. They were all near the top of the standings, but no one was running away with it. So the Phillies enter 1980 with a 96-year curse hanging around their necks. They didn't have a cute name for their curse like the Red Sox curse of Babe Ruth. They didn't have a cute name like the curse of the Billy Goat like the Chicago Cubs. And we remember when the Red Sox and the Cubs won their World Series, how huge it was that they finally broke the curse. There was a lot of conversation and talk about the Phillies' 96-year drought, but not to the degree of the Red Sox and the Cubs. Because for almost a full century, the Phillies were just a really bad baseball team. They had so many last-place finishes. They made the postseason just five times in 96 years. Pennants in 1915 and 1950, along with those three straight NL East titles in the mid-70s. It was a cavalcade of losses. And I detail the 1980 season in depth in a longer piece for The Good Fight, which I put out here on Thursday morning. I think that when you look back at the 1980 Phillies, you see a team that knew this was their last shot. They knew that this was the last chance that they were going to get. But even knowing all of that, they still ran into problems in August. In fact, there was a mid-August doubleheader. It was on August 10th. The Phillies were in Pittsburgh playing the Pirates. And in the first game of a doubleheader, they lost 7-1. Dallas Green was livid. He was incensed. And he ripped into the team in a team meeting in between games of the doubleheader. At the time, we know him as a legendary Eagles writer, Ray Dinger, was covering the Phillies for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Green, he wrote about the incident in which Green was screaming at his players, saying, "This bleeping game isn't easy. It's tough, especially when you have injuries. But you guys have got your bleeping heads down. You've got to stop being so bleeping cool. Get that through your bleeping heads. Lots of bleeps. If you don't, you'll get so buried, it ain't gonna be funny." He's saying, "Get off your butts." I'm cleaning this language up a little bit, by the way. "And just be the way you can be because you're a good bleeping baseball team. But you're not now, and you can't look in the mirror and tell me you are. You tell me you can do it, but you bleeping give up. If you don't want a bleeping play, get the bleep in that office and bleeping tell me because I don't want to bleeping play you." Lots of bleeps from Dallas Green, which was not unusual. His tirade did not have an immediate impact. They went out and lost the second game of that doubleheader 4-1. And as Dinger wrote, again, remember in 1980, there was also a presidential election campaign going on. And at this point in August, they were still having primaries, I guess. Or there hadn't been a nominee just yet. And Dinger wrote, "The Phillies have about as much chance of winning the National League East as Ted Kennedy has of stealing the Democratic nomination away from Jimmy Carter. But like a crusty old campaign manager, Dallas Green is not about to concede until the last delegate is counted." You want to know why Ray Dinger's in the Writers Hall of Fame? It's great stuff like that. Really nothing happened until the players had a meeting of their own when they returned back to Philadelphia. Now, they essentially said that they were just going to play for themselves and forget about Green. But whatever it was, that meeting by Green in Pittsburgh was the catalyst. Because the 1980 Phillies went 35-19 following their Pittsburgh debacle and quickly worked their way up the standings. Finally entering the last, after a four-game home series against the Cubs in late September, the Phillies entered the final series of the season at 89-70, tied with the Expos for first place in the NL East, setting up a winner-take-all three-game series at Montreal. This was a Montreal team that was loaded with talent. You had Gary Carter, who was the MVP runner-up in 1980 to Mike Schmidt, just 26 years old, led the Expos in homers with 29 and 100 and RBIs with 121. Andre Dawson finished 7th in the MVP voting. They had right fielder Ellis Valentine, first baseman Warren Cromartie. Steve Rogers was the staff ace. Scott Sanderson, Bill Gullickson, Charlie Lee, David Palmer, all very good members of that starting rotation. Whoever won the series was going to win the National League East. The Phillies jumped out on top in the first game of the series with a 2-1 win, powered by Schmidt, had a sacrifice fly and a solo home run in that game. Dick Ruthven had a fantastic start, which put the Phillies up by one game with two to play. And then the following day, on the penultimate game of the season, the Phillies held a 3-2 lead in the seventh, only to watch Montreal regain the lead with two of their own in the bottom of the inning. But that's when you would see this team's personality in October begin to take shape. You just couldn't count this team out in the late innings. Rose led off the ninth inning with a walk, followed by groundouts from Bake McBride and Mike Schmidt that resulted in McBride standing on second with two out. Bob Boone, who almost lost his job to Keith Moreland during the course of the season, singled a ball to center to score McBride and tie the game at five. And then in the top of the 11th with a runner on, Mike Schmidt hit his NL-leading 48th homer of the season, the biggest one he'd ever hit, to give the Phillies a 6-4 lead. And that, of course, was the Andy Musser call. He buried it. He buried it way back out of here. And so that was the home run that won the National League East for the Phillies. They were going to get one more shot at this World Series. We all know what happened next. A legendary five-game series in Houston. The Phillies down 2-1 with two to play at the Houston Astrodome. They come back. All four of the five games go to extra innings. It is the greatest five-game playoff series in baseball history. In game four, the Phillies are down late again. They manage to they score three runs in the eighth to jump on top 3-2. But then the Astros tie it in the bottom of the ninth. So the game goes to extra innings, and we remember Pete Rose rounding third on a Greg Luzinski double to left field on a play where he clearly should have stopped at third base. The third baseman is standing 15 feet behind the bag when he receives the throw from the left fielder. Rose has just rounded third base at this point. Rose should have been out by 30 feet. It was a boneheaded decision, but Rose just felt there was no way he was going to be out. The throw ends up short-hopping Bruce Bochy, who was catching for the Astros at the time. Rose runs over him and scores the go-ahead run, and then the Phillies would tack on an insurance run to win that thriller 5-3, forcing a fifth game that turned out to be one of the greatest games in baseball history. I think the MLB Network had it at number 18. It's got to be higher on the list than that. And it was one of the greatest games in the sport's history. Back and forth. In the early innings, the Phillies had a 2-1 lead, and they maintained that lead with two outs at home plate. Manny Trio with a relay throw from the outfield on a ball that looked for sure like it was going to be a run-scoring double. And then a couple innings later, on a ground ball to Manny Trio, threw wide to Pete Rose at first base for what looked to be an infield single. The Astros tried to catch the Phillies napping. Pete Rose wheeled around, threw to home, and Bob Boone got spiked on the play, but managed to get another out at home plate, which kept the score 2-1. The Astros, however, rallied in the middle innings and went into the eighth inning ahead 5-2 with Nolan Ryan, their ace on the hill. According to Baseball Reference, Houston had a 96% chance of winning the game at that point. But that's when things got crazy. Boa led off with a single, which was followed by a Boone infield hit that deflected off of Ryan's glove. Probably should have been a double play. Then pinch hitter extraordinaire Greg Gross laid down a perfect bunt single down the third baseline to load the bases with nobody out. You remember Howard Cosell on TV yelling, "The Phillies have loaded the bases in about 30 seconds. That's what it seemed like. Nolan Ryan then walks Pete Rose to force in a run. They get Ryan out of the game. Moreland hits an RBI groundout to make it 5-4. Schmidt strikes out when all he needed was a sacrifice fly to get the Phillies tied, but Del Unser bails him out and hits a single to center that ties the game up, and then eventual NLCS MVP Manny Trio follows with a triple down the left field line to give the Phillies a 7-5 lead. But the Astros weren't done. Incredibly, the Astros in the bottom of the eighth inning score two runs to tie the game at 7. Game 5 was going to extra innings too. In the 10th, after another huge Unser hit, a double down the right field line, Gary Maddox singles him to center. a single to center to drive him to drive home Unser to put the Phillies on top 8-7. Dick Ruthven retired the Astros in order in the bottom of the 10th to give the Phillies just their third pennant in team history. Now, the curse is still not dead, folks. That just got the Phillies into their third fall classic. They still had to play a Kansas City Royals team that won 97 games in the regular season, that swept the New York Yankees in the American League Championship Series. And the Royals had their own demons. They had lost three straight league championship series, two of them to the New York Yankees in those years. But the Royals finally overcame the Yankees. They had the two best third basemen in baseball were playing in this World Series. George Brett hit .390 that year. He was five hits shy of being the first qualified batter to hit .400 since Ted Williams in 1941. They had Amos Otis, Willie Akins, Hal McRae, Willie Wilson. They were terrors in the World Series. And this World Series was, you know, two teams that had never won the World Series before, two teams that had first-year managers in their first full seasons, the best third baseman in each league. This was the World Series, the first World Series that would be played entirely on artificial turf, by the way, and the first fall classic since 1920 in which neither team had won a World Series before. Game one was a classic. The Phillies were down 4-0 in the third inning before a dramatic comeback powered by a Bake McBride three-run home run that put the Phillies up 5-4. They'd go on to win 7-6 in game one. In game two, George Brett had to leave the game due to a battle with hemorrhoids, but the Royals still led 4-2 in the eighth inning with the best closer in baseball, Dan Quisenberry, trying to get the last six outs. He led the league in saves that year with 33, finished fifth in the AL Cy Young voting. However, the Phillies staged yet another late inning rally and put four runs on Quisenberry in the bottom of the eighth to shock the Royals 6-4 and take a two games to series lead heading to Kansas City. That's when some home cooking helped the Royals. The Phillies trailed 3-2 heading into the eighth inning in Game 3, but a Rose single scored Boa to make it a 3-3 game. It went to extra innings, but a Willie Akins walk-off single gave the Royals a 4-3 win. And then in Game 4, they jumped all over Larry Christensen early and scored four in the first in a game they would win 5-3. But of course, Game 4 was where the turning point of the series happened. And it just goes to show you that a turning point can happen even in a loss. With Kansas City up 5-1 in the fourth, Dickie Knowles threw a fastball right underneath George Brett's chin, which sent Brett sprawling to the ground. KC manager Jim Frey charged out of the dugout like an aged bull released from his cage, screaming at the umpires to kick Knowles out of the game. Pete Rose started yelling at Frey to get back in the dugout, and then he yelled at Knowles, "You pitch your game!" And that message pitch seemed to wake the Phillies up, if they needed to be woken up. Game 5 in Kansas City, the Phillies looked like they might not be able to pull this thing off. And according to a 2019 ESPN ranking of every World Series ever played, the 1980 World Series came in at number 16 overall. It was called a true classic, with Game 5 being the highlight of the series. And in the ESPN write-up, they called this the greatest Game 5 in World Series history. The Phillies came from behind with a two-run rally in the ninth inning, started by a Mike Schmidt infield single, and finished with a Manny Trio single off Dan Quisenberry's glove. The Royals then loaded the bases on three Tug McGraw walks in the bottom of the ninth before McGraw escaped and tilted the series in the Phillies' favor. According to ESPN, by average leverage index, this is the closest nine-inning game in World Series history. Finally, in Game 6, with a record 31.2 million households watching, roughly 40% of all TVs in America, according to Nielsen, tuned in to find out if the Phillies could break the curse. It still today remains the most watched game in World Series history, a record that will likely never be topped thanks to cable and streaming options and just other sports having taken more prominence in the television landscape. The Phillies got it done. Steve Carlton got the start in Game 6, and his fastball seemed 2 to 3 miles an hour faster than normal. His slider was unhittable. He went seven innings, gave up one run on four hits, seven strikeouts, three walks. Mike Schmidt hit a huge two-run single in the third inning to put the Phillies up 2-0. The Phillies entered the ninth inning with a 4-1 lead, and McGraw, who at this point was leaking oil, needing three more outs to end the curse. But the Royals would not go quietly. They loaded the bases in the bottom of the ninth. In the top of the ninth. With one out, Frank White hits a foul pop right in front of the Phillies dugout, and you all remember this play. Bob Boone and Pete Rose racing over to the dugout. It squirts out of Boone's glove in the air, Rose right there to snag it out of the air and record the second out. That's when you knew the Phillies were winning this thing. With one more out to go and 60,000 fans screaming, mounted police horses trotting onto the field to deal with what they must have thought would be a riot afterwards, McGraw got ahead 1-2 on Willie Wilson. Wilson had struggled mightily in this series. I think he'd struck out 11 times. McGraw reared back through one last fastball that Wilson swung through, and the curse was broken. The Phillies, in their 97th year of existence, finally had their title. And of course, it kicked off maybe the greatest parade in Philadelphia sports history. I can't compare the 80 World Series and the 2017 Super Bowl because I'm only aware of the 2017 Super Bowl, but it looked like the 1980 parade at least matched it and may have been the superior parade just because 96 years of waiting was the curse was finally broken. All of those near misses in 76, 77, and 78 eased, not wiped away, but eased. And the Phillies finally, after decades of futility, nearly a century without a World Series title, had won the 1980 World Series. And that was celebrated this week, 40 years ago, as the Phillies won the 1980 World Series over the Kansas City Royals. And folks, that'll do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. My thanks to Dan Zimborski for joining the podcast. Hey, here's a reminder, guys. Don't forget to check out the Hittin' Season Patreon that we have up there. There's a new Absolutely Hammered up there for you with Justin and Chris Jones. And you can get that by going to patreon.com/hittin'season. And would also ask you to please check out the other Good Fight podcasts and leave a 5-star rating and a review at the Good Fight podcast feed. Make sure to check out our new Phillies Major League Baseball podcast, Up and In. It is a quick hitting daily, less than 10-minute podcast to get you caught up on all the latest Phillies and Major League Baseball news every single morning. So make sure you check that out every morning here on the Good Fight podcast feed, Up and In, featuring myself, Justin Clue, and Chris Jones. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time here on Hittin' Season.